Welcome to the Project Love podcast. I'm Selena Barker.
And I'm Vicky Pavitt. In these podcasts, we explore what it takes to create a life, relationship, and career you love.
And not just one that looks good on the outside, but one that feels good on the inside.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Project Love podcast. It's Vicky here, the love and dating coach of the Project Love duo, and I have a really special episode to share with you this week. I had the privilege of sitting down with a fellow lover of love, Natasha Lunn, to talk about her new book, Conversations on Love. As well as being a writer and author, Natasha is also the features director at Red Magazine. I first met Natasha a few years ago, and I learn something new about love every time I talk to her. She speaks about love with such reverence and wisdom. Speaking with her is always such a treat. In her new book, Conversations on Love, she asks three main questions. How do we find love? How do we sustain it? And how do we survive when we lose it? The book features interviews with the likes of Alain de Botton, Philippa Perry, Esther Perel, Candice Carty-Williams, Porna Bell, Dolly Alderton, Roxane Gay, Diana Evans, and so many more. When it comes to love, this book really does have it all. I loved every second of reading it. Each page offered a deeper understanding of what it means to love and be loved, and what it means to live a life of meaning. I felt so in love reading it, which Natasha tells me was one of her aims with the book, to have you feeling in love as you read about love. And in this podcast episode, I felt that same in love feeling that I felt when reading the book. Conversations on Love is available now, and I'll add the link in the show notes. I know I'm going to be buying it for so many friends when it comes out. I was actually sending friends pictures of highlighted sections of the book when I was reading it, and so they'll be really pleased to know that the book is now out. So I know many, many friends that I'm going to be gifting this book to over the summer. Okay, so without further ado, here is the wonderful episode with Natasha Lunn. I hope you enjoy it. Natasha, a huge welcome to the Project Love podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you on. And we've been talking about this for a while, haven't we?
Yes, I feel like we've been having this podcast conversation already between us for so long now. It's nice to do it officially.
Natasha got here. We're at my house doing this one in person. And Natasha got here. Must have been like an hour and a half ago, we were like, we'll have a quick chat and then we'll hit record. And an hour and a half later, we were like, oh, we need to actually record this and stop having all the conversation outside of the recording. So here we are. I'm so looking forward to talking to you about your new book, Conversations on Love. I have it here. It's been my companion over the last few weeks as I've been sitting in cafes again.
I'm loving the highlighted section. Yeah. I can spy. Vicky's got heart-shaped post-its in her book, which is very on brand.
I've got like every page pretty much has got some sort of, there's an orange highlighter thing going on, lots of orange highlighted sections and even heart post-it notes. So very apt for a book on love. I absolutely loved reading this book. I felt like every page gave me a deeper understanding of what it means to love and be loved, but also what it means to live a life of meaning as well. And I felt so seen in these pages. At times I felt really moved to tears, and I just really felt in love reading this book on love. So thank you. First of all, thank you so much for writing it.
Well, as I am, I did want the process of reading the book to feel like being in love. So I was thinking about all the things you feel when you're in love. So challenged, seen, accountable, acknowledged, grateful, and also just for people to kind of, I guess, have the feeling when you're being in love is really about feeling less alone. So whether you're in friendships or family or relationships, it's having that kind of connection which makes you feel like, oh, I feel seen in myself, and I know that how I feel is not, doesn't mean that I'm alone in the world. So I think that's, I wanted people to feel like they were in love as they were reading the book. Mm. Also, because there's a section on how books have been, for me, a form of love, and actually reading something from a writer who I admire or feel similar to in some way, did feel for me when I was really lonely, like love. I would read a paragraph about, you know, Sarah Hoppola, one of the people I've interviewed, and I'd read a paragraph of hers and I would feel like, oh, I'm not the only one who feels like this. You, this very specific, strange, sometimes shameful feeling that I've had is one that she has too. And that feels like a kind of, she calls it a union of the souls. And so, you know, books have really been that for me. So I was hoping, you know, especially by being honest about things that I might have thought were shameful at some points in my life, other people might feel that too.
I find that too with books, that you can read something and it feels like the writer's articulated something that you've never really been able to grasp or like find the words for, and they've just said it there on the page and it's like, oh my God, that's what it is. I feel so seen.
Yeah. And there was one specific thing in Sarah's interview, and she says she flits between feeling superior and feeling inferior. And I've had so many people screenshot that paragraph to me, because it's quite a strange thing to be, to acknowledge that really strange feeling of like flitting between that. You know, you're not just insecure. In some ways you feel you're above somebody or the situation, but some ways you feel completely insecure. And yeah, I'd never really heard somebody talk about that before. And then I realized that everybody, so many of the readers had felt that.
So interesting. I felt like, because you've got such a vast array of teachers really on love, from Alain de Botton to Esther Perel to Susie Orbach, and, you know, so many, Philippa Perry, so many amazing, prolific writers, thinkers and experts on love. And there was a, I felt the whole book just took me on this journey. And, you know, I'd turn the page and then you're like, oh, now we're going to speak to Esther Perel. I was like, brilliant, great. You know, sat there. I'm just like waiting for you to tell me, like, who's next? What's next, Natasha? And like all the, many of the books that I'd read years ago, like Stephen Gross, The Examined Mind. Is it The Examined Mind?
Examined Life.
The Examined Life I'd read years ago. And it was so great to reflect on those books that I'd read before, but now they were kind of coming back into my life as well.
Yeah, I think... Also, I've read a lot of books like, you know, when you're interested in love, like we do, lots of expert books and kind of like psychology books, and then lots of like amazing memoirs and love stories. And I kind of wanted to bridge the gap between the two and try and share some of the, like, I guess more like therapeutic, therapy-based learnings about love, but not from the perspective of somebody who's like, I've learned all this and I know everything, from the perspective of somebody like me who is, you know, has so little understanding of love when I was younger, has made so many mistakes, kind of coming at it on a sort of quest to understand with the reader. So I guess I'm learning with the reader. For the first section it was different because I'm looking back at younger years of my life, but the second two I was very much like the quote that I use, like living the questions as I was going, because my life was sort of unfolding as I was asking the questions. So I am like learning with you.
Yeah, that really came across. It felt like we were going on a journey together.
Yes, yeah. And now still the journey, you know, even by the end, you're still learning. Like I'm still making some of those mistakes, and yeah, it still feels like it's ongoing.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, actually. You said that one of the things that you've learned about love is that it's a lifelong project.
Yes. Well, yeah, I guess I, in my narrow view of love, I did used to think that if I fell in love and met somebody, that I guess I would have, like, it's like you've completed some sort of level in love and you've got a version of it, and then it just sort of ticks along. You know, you work at it, but it's pretty much, you know, you found your person and you're together. But I just have been completely, my views completely changed, because I see how fragile love is actually. And there was one person I've interviewed called Mira Jacob, who said in long-term love, we don't talk about it as fragile. Like in the early stages of dating, we're like, this could go wrong. This, you know, it feels very fragile, but we shy away from fragility in long-term love because it feels like more of a threat. And she uses the example of people who have got divorced, and she's like, you know, when did you know things have gone wrong? They said, we've had a really bad 2 years. And she'd say, you've been together for 30 years. How can 2 bad years undo that whole relationship? But it's true, like, you do have something happens, a financial struggle or a sick parent, and your relationship really goes through a process of change. And so you, if you don't keep working at it, if you don't keep working on the project, then it can fade and it can break. And it's not something that you acquire and get to keep. Like, you have to keep earning it. And I think I've really felt that, you know, not just in my marriage, but, and not just in my friendships, but even with my relationship with my parents, you know, just because they're your parents doesn't mean that that love is just going to stay there and be constant unless you really make space for it and keep, you know, we grow up not really being that active in love with our parents. Mm. So for me, it's been like a real realization. That is part of my project of love too, to treat them as individuals and humans rather than just the person who I lean on, and getting to be know them and being curious about who they are as individuals. So maybe it's not just project, like, there's so many different projects that you're constantly working on if you're lucky enough to have lots of different relationships in your life.
What I loved is just how expansive the book is and how you go into so many different forms of love. And I know, I think we talked in the last podcast when you were on a few years back about romantic love. Did we talk about romantic love being, yes, you know, idealized on a pedestal?
Did you idealize romantic love?
Yeah. So growing up, so our patterns in love are really similar. I lost myself in romantic relationships time and time again. And I always thought that it was an issue with the other person. And then I always felt like something was missing in those relationships. And through self-reflection, only later did I realize that what was missing was me. And I think that I'd put so much expectation and pressure on romantic love because I'd been, you know, really influenced by the fairy tale stories. It's really misrepresented, you know, and idealized. And what I loved about your book is that it really expands that notion of love and really celebrates love in all its forms.
I tried to do that because I think I suffered from that narrow, exactly like you, like idealizing romantic love. And I realized that even when I've actually did find romantic love, I also realized how important it is for that relationship as well to have different forms of love. And actually that no romantic relationship can exist in some sort of siloed individual state. Because, you know, I think, for instance, my husband is a primary school teacher, is not really interested in like the writing world or maybe like love and relationships world. And so there is that whole portion of my life that, you know, he will show an interest in the stuff that I'm doing, but it's not that he's going to be picking up Eric Fromm and saying, let's talk about this. And I have friends who are in that world who I will for 3 hours talk about writers, talk about therapists, talk about all that stuff. And that is a part of me that they see that he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't need him to be that for me because I have those other people. And just in the same way that he'll have different versions of himself that different friends and family see. So I think I always almost thought, like, mustn't idealize romantic love because, you know, that's bad to do. I should actually, it's almost like I was morally wrong to be doing that. It's actually a more enjoyable life when you are seen by lots of different people in different ways. It's like, just makes everything more fun and you feel, I don't know, more challenged and acknowledged. And it's almost in the same way of when I started doing interviews, I think I would try and seek out people who were quite similar to me and have similar story because I'd be thinking, I want to have the answers. And actually now the people who are most different to me have turned out to be some of the most rewarding interviews. I think like you can't really talk about love unless you see it in that expansive way. Mm-hmm. And this is a bit cheesy, but the way I tried to like describe, because I wanted it to be like that Love Actually moment in the airport at the end, you know, when it's like everyone's saying hello and meeting. That's kind of the feeling I wanted the book to have.
Well, it's funny you say that because the day after I finished the book, the next morning, I picked up my phone and I thought, I'll put a podcast on for my walk. I was walking the dog in the morning and I thought, actually, I'm going to just be really present on this walk and I'm going to notice all of the forms of love on this walk. And there were just so many. It was like, you know, love for a stranger who let me cross, and he gave me this wave and laughed at me because I was like running with the dog, and you know, that little moment with a stranger. And I love connecting with strangers in that way, just smiling at strangers.
It makes you feel amazing. It's like a real, like that did come up a lot for me. Like I can remember like certain smile of a certain person at a certain time. And it, you know, if when I was younger, if you said to me love of strangers, I'd be like, oh yeah, it's just a nice thing. But it's so powerful.
Yeah, so powerful. I have this ritual where every day I do smile at as many people as I can when I'm out walking, when I walk the dog. And just, you know, if I'm feeling brave, I'll also say good morning, you know, on my walk. And sometimes, you know, you get this like really enthusiastic morning back, and other times people ignore you and it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's just like that act of doing it just brings me so much joy. It was a really sunny day, and I could smell the blossom. It was jasmine that I could smell. It's just jasmine smells so sweet.
Oh, yeah.
And just like really like appreciating, you know, like all the blooms, fresh blooms in the park, and, you know, the birds singing, and there's a butterfly. And I just felt this love of nature that was just amazing to really be present to, that I wouldn't have maybe been as present to if I was like, you know, in a podcast and kind of on my phone. And then there was love for my dog, just watching him, just being himself, like just finding things to sniff and going to try and play with other dogs and getting rejected. It's just like the love for him. And I thought, God, it is true, the love actually thing, that it is all around.
Yeah.
And you just need to pay attention.
And love in nature, I think, is something that I really felt. And actually always when I feel most vulnerable or maybe sad or like it's tender moments in my life, I'm always drawn back to nature and just to the sea. Or, you know, I really feel like whenever I feel vulnerable, I'm like always drawn back to being in nature. And I do think that, you know, I do believe in love in nature. And actually a lot of people I've spoken to have had moments where, you know, there's an interview with Greg Wise when he's talking about after his sister and just being, you know, using his hands on the earth and gardening and growing. And I do feel like that is a form of love that we overlook.
And the wisdom as well. I remember the interview with Greg Wise, and he was talking about how, you know, we can learn so much from nature because it's cyclical, it's seasonal.
Yes.
It was really interesting.
Yeah. And that things kind of like die and go back into the soil and grow again.
Yeah, the rebirth, the death and rebirth.
Mm.
Yeah. So I wrote a post recently, a love letter post on the myth of the one. And the main message was that you don't find the one, you go on a journey to become each other's one. And that journey, you know, is going to have ups and downs and twists and turns along the way. It's not like you arrive at this perfect person or that there's this, like one perfect person out there for us. And I felt that what Philippa Perry was saying about mutual impact, that it really spoke to that.
She said no one is right for anyone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And when she was saying this idea of mutual impact where you both move each other, I was thinking how much that is really about how you reach, well, it's kind of really about intimacy.
It's such a, I found like with so many things in love, there's such a delicate balance because that means that you're required, you know, you're allowing yourself to change with another person, which is very different from changing yourself purely for that other person.
Yeah.
And that's the really tricky distinction, isn't it? It's like you can't squash your personality into a different shape because you think that's what the person wants. Mm. But you do have to allow each other to have an impact and change each other. And I think that that was something that I found really difficult to learn because I would change too much. And when you change too much, then you know, it's just so difficult to, you lose track of what you want or what you need. Or, you know, I remember looking back on Spotify at a playlist I'd made when I was with a certain boyfriend. And I honestly don't recognize the bands, the songs. Like obviously I was just making a playlist because I thought he's into that kind of music. I want to be this kind of woman. Mm. And it's so strange to me because it almost feels like it was made by a stranger. I can't understand how I would have been the person to make that playlist. So yeah, I think that you're completely right. You have to, you know, there's another line that Mira Jacob says was like, you never really choose a person. What you choose is how you weather change with and alongside that person. So, you know, you don't know who that person is going to be in 10, 20 years time or whatever, but you do know how the two of you will weather change. And if you can kind of see that that is the important thing, then whether the change is a death of a parent, someone losing their job, it doesn't matter what the specific thing is. You know that you can together negotiate and like collaborate and listen to each other through those moments of change. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, it's not, you know, I'm a different person now than I was when I, you know, in some ways than when I met my partner. If he'd have wanted that person, he would have now been disappointed because he'd be like, well, where's that version of you? But what we choose is, you know, kind of committing to keep knowing each other through all our different phases and versions. And actually that is part of what makes long-term love more interesting. I think that's something with the fantasy, it can sound exciting. And, you know, I used to think about long-term love as more of this steady companionship. And, you know, I had to give up all that sort of exciting, exhilarating feelings, which, you know, it's important to give up the fantasy. But I have found that long-term love is still like erotic and mysterious, can still be dangerous. You know, the kind of threat gets bigger and bigger and you've got more to lose. And it's not this like safe, comforting experience always. It's still this changing, mysterious thing, which has been, I've almost like loved being surprised by long-term love in that way.
Yeah, I found the same actually. I've just celebrated 10 years with Pam.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. And you know, we are not the same people as we were a decade ago. I was 26 when we you know, started a relationship. So yeah, like, and he isn't the same either. And, you know, luckily we have evolved and grown together and we've really, you know, we've influenced each other and we have changed, but luckily we've changed together.
If you commit to building a life with someone, then they, you know, they have a complete change in it, something that doesn't sit with you or doesn't fit with you anymore, then maybe it's just not going to work. But I think, certainly what I noticed, if I think back now about, you know, you have certain like big conversations in your first year, if you're, I don't know, conversation about where the relationship's going or, I don't know, just whether to move in, those. I think it's really interesting to notice how each of you have those conversations. Like, is it easy? Is it, do they shut down or are you able to actually have a space where you can negotiate and talk about things? And I think, you know, I always used to think a lot about, you know, type and what was common or different between the men I dated. But I think what's more important is what are the conversations that you're having like? How do you feel when you are having those, you know, conversations where you feel more vulnerable? I think that's what I wish that I had looked at more than what kind of music did they like?
Oh, now I want to read. There's a quote that I'd never heard of before by Adrian Rich.
I think there's two interesting parts of the quote. It's basically saying you have to value yourself enough that even if something was not possible for you, like she calls it like extraneous delights were taken away. Like in my head, I was thinking of it of like, even if I was going to lose a person in a romantic relationship, I needed to be sure enough of myself that I wouldn't give everything away to keep it. So like, even if that's withheld, you need to take responsibility for valuing yourself enough that you're not going to give everything away because you're afraid of losing something. It was really about having responsibility for yourself. And just understanding your own value, I guess. And it was, you know, I used it because basically I had done the opposite and given away everything, just trying to sort of frantically grasp onto these relationships. Like I would have, you know, I just like would have like bent the world to try and keep them. It didn't matter what I had to give up. I was just, that was the only focus. And, you know, when you've got that like panicky feeling and you're just constantly like, you know, it's, they would ask to meet you and you just change all your plans, drop everything to try and like frantically think that if I saw you that certain time, then I can keep the relationship going. It's just this panicked state to exist in.
Yeah. And that really resonates with me. And I think I did things like that because I wanted to be close as a way of being closer to them.
Yeah.
So that you wouldn't be abandoned. But in doing so, you end up abandoning yourself. And I think that is the most painful thing of all, when you've abandoned yourself.
And also, you know, like the example I use in the book is like when you're screwing on a jar, a lid on a jar. And like, even though it looks like you're turning it, you can kind of feel the ridges are out of line. And that's how I felt in so many of those relationships. Like I knew, of course, I knew that it wasn't right, or they didn't love me, or it wasn't, you know, I guess I would hope that it would change, but I felt like it was slipping away from me as I was in it. And it's just such an exhausting state to exist in. And I think once you get to that point, I don't think that any amount of frantically scrabbling around is going to change the situation. I think it's like, there's one bit in the book where we talk about, you know, love being work, but the act of someone loving you, like it should be easy. Like if you feel like someone is making you feel like you're difficult to love, then I don't think that that is love.
Yes.
So another, again, it's like another really tricky distinction, because the maintenance of a relationship is work, but the love should be easy.
Yeah. The loving.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to convince someone or scrabble around to like try and make them love you. Like they either they do or they don't.
Yeah. There was an idea of self-love that you, I think you asked Alain de Botton about it. And it's something that I have been thinking about over the years as well. It's this idea that you have to love yourself before you can love somebody else. And I think I agreed with that back in the day, but recently, probably over the last 2-3 years, I've started to kind of, it didn't really resonate with me and my journey, because my self-love journey started at the same time as my relationship with my husband 10 years ago. And they were, they both kind of ran in parallel. And I felt like that relationship helped me to love myself. And then my self-love then helps the relationship. So it wasn't this linear thing that I had one and now I'm ready for the next, like a kind of level. It was like the two were going in tandem, and the, and they benefit each other.
I hate this idea that you have to love yourself before you, because to me, it's just as unhelpful as the myth of like finding the right person, because there's no state of self-love you reach and then finish. Like it's always a continuous thing. Like I think it would be troubling if you met somebody and they just love themselves all the time and that was it. You know, for me, it was like another thing. I felt like I was a failure. I was like, no one's ever going to love me because I feel insecure. And actually, it's just rubbish. Like all of us are going to have times when we feel, when we kind of have self-love, and times when we're like unkind to ourselves. And that doesn't mean that you're unlovable. And it doesn't mean that a relationship is impossible. And I just think there are so many different ways. I know people who met their partner when they were 13. And of course, they didn't have anything figured out there. Yeah. And then they sort of learn with and alongside them. And I know some people who really struggled to understand themselves, and that meant that they did need to be on their own until their 40s. So I don't think that there is a kind of like gimmicky line about loving yourself before you can find someone. I really hate it. I think it made me feel like even more of a failure. And I do think that a relationship, good relationship, can be a little like therapy. You don't want to depend on it to figure out your issues, but it echoes the process of therapy, is in it's a really safe place for you to work out issues, to share things. And actually a lot of stuff, you know, if you look at attachment, you learn about yourself in response to other people.
Yeah.
So it's crazy that we think we can like learn and love everything about ourselves on our own. Like you can also do that with another person.
Yeah.
And I'd say actually some of the most useful things about myself I learn in the relationship when I feel like uncomfortable, I'm reacting a certain way that kind of gives me a clue, like, why am I finding this so difficult? And then I will sort of reason through it. So yeah, I think it just can make the problem with that is it can make people feel like if they can't love themselves fully and completely, then they're going to be alone forever.
And I've heard Esther Perel talk about this before, and it's kind of like the distinction between individualism versus like thinking relationally.
Mm.
And the fact that, well, actually there was something that Alicia Malik said in relation to this. She said, you have to learn to understand yourself in relation to people around you. And I think that's it. Like what you just said, we learn so much in the container of a relationship because it's not just learning about ourselves and then going out into the world and kind of being this fixed person who is unchangeable and unmoved by the person they're with. So what Philippa Perry was saying about mutual impact, you know, not allowing that impact. It's about kind of being vulnerable and letting yourself be impacted by the other person and kind of allowing that to happen.
Yeah. And I think it's Alan who says maybe it's more about self-understanding than self-love.
Yeah.
And actually, of course, if you have no understanding of yourself and, you know, if you have whatever issues you have, that can make it very difficult to be in a relationship. You know, you do need some kind of emotional responsibility and awareness to make the relationship work and to be able to move through change with another person. But I think that you can kind of understand yourself without feeling like totally loving to yourself all the time. I just think that is an unrealistic goal. And like love is also an ongoing project.
Mm, yeah. You don't reach a destination like the relationship. No, you don't get to the end of it. It just
evolves. And I would hate people to think, oh, I have to figure out how to love myself before I can try to start dating or before I can, you know, be worthy of someone loving me. I hate that idea.
Yeah, because it's rooted in perfectionism.
Mm.
And I think it relates to something that Emily, remind me of her surname?
Nagoski
says about wanting and desire and how it's rooted in capitalism.
Mm. One of the reasons that I was ready to write that book now is that I thought that state of craving, of wanting, was very specific for me to a romantic relationship. And that once I had it, then that kind of feeling would go. But then it was amazing, like the similarities between that kind of craving, searching for a romantic partner, and wanting and trying to have a baby in my 30s. I thought I had mature enough to kind of not exist in that state of obsessive longing again, overlooking all the rest of the love in my life. But actually, although the thing that I was longing for had changed, I was back in that state of wanting. And I understood that I would probably be back in it again if I wanted a second child, or if that child was sick and I wanted her to be well. Like there's always some sort of craving of wanting that you can get really lost inside and is, I think, a big threat to love.
Mm. Yeah. And I think you talked about it in the way of it leading to loneliness as well, like the longing to be somewhere else other than here.
Mm.
When I was reading the bits on longing, it really reminded me of my own longing to move house. And I'm in a one room studio flat, which is a big, big space, but it's just one room. And in lockdown, it's been quite challenging to try and navigate, you know.
With a dog as well.
Like with a dog and me and my husband both trying to grow our businesses, you know, all in the same room and nowhere else to go, etc. You know, so it's been really challenging. And we've been here 9 years now. And I really thought we would have moved out by now. So it's this expectation that I'm not kind of where I should be or want to be, you know, want to be able to actually buy a property and make that step. And I know our situations are totally different when you were talking about your longing, but the kind of feeling of longing, like really was what I felt in terms of wanting to not be here, not be in the flat and being in lockdown, you know, is really causing me a lot of stress.
Mm.
I think it was the root of a lot of unhappiness where I would get obsessed, you know, I'd be on Rightmove and looking at all these things.
Oh my gosh, the Rightmove session, yeah.
And just like we couldn't really do anything about that particular situation at the time. So, you know, that acceptance that actually, you know, find the joy and happiness in terms of where you are and to appreciate that even if that got sorted out, so if I was to, you know, move house and that would have all been, you know, sorted, there would be the next thing that I would be longing for as well. So it really helped me to see that, you know, this longing is a human, you know, it's part of the human experience, but that we can learn to manage it so that we don't cause ourselves misery.
And keep it in check. And it's funny, isn't it? Because with both of our situations, you know, I was so happy in my relationship before I entered that state of longing. And it felt like enough. And we were had such a full, rich life. And then when I was sort of propelled into that state of longing, suddenly all I could see was like the lack of love, even though just the year before I'd been so happy. And it's like you in this flat, you know, you've been happy here. Suddenly when you flip into that longing, then you're like miserable and you're looking, but you, well, practically nothing has changed and you have been very happy living here. So it's, I think it's natural to long for things. And, you know, that is sometimes, that is what motivates us to take a next step. But I think it's just keeping it in check, just not letting it spread out and just like I describe it as like a mist that spread out into my life and I just couldn't see anything else.
Yeah.
And I think that's when longing gets dangerous, when it just sort of saps away all the color from your life.
Yeah, that's it. When it has you missing the moments, really, the moments that matter. You know, like you say, before I started this kind of adventure, I guess, of like project move house, I was like waking up in the flat feeling so grateful to be here. I really love the space, you know, for the previous 8 years that I've lived here.
Yeah.
You're so right. And it's funny, there was this kind of like a competition in my area. So Hackney is where I live, and Hackney Council were offering this kind of opportunity to win a plot of land in Hackney where you could build your own home. And me and Pav entered this last year and we worked on it like a project together, which was super fun, like designing our dream home and what it would, you know, look like. And it's funny, as soon as we sent that off, so we sent that off in December, there was like a 6 month period of like waiting to find out if we'd won or not. Mm. And I felt that it gave me such hope and optimism in those 6 months because there was something out there, a possibility.
Yeah.
And there was something that you wrote about hope and how it's okay, even if it's a false hope, hope can be so, such a great form of resilience, really, to help you to navigate challenges. And I really felt that for me in that whole kind of 12 months of longing, the 6 months where something was out there in the world and there was a possibility there, even though we just recently found out that we weren't the winners of this amazing plot of land, which would have been a bit of a miracle anyway.
But also could have come with its own challenges.
It's totally,
like,
yeah.
Like there's always whatever you know, if you had have moved out of here in lockdown, you'd probably be longing for that opportunity to go to your local cafe with a book in London, central London.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And, but I just think that hope, because sometimes I think people hold back on hope because they think, oh, it's not safe to hope because then I could be disappointed. When you wrote about hope, I felt that that was, it changed my relationship to hope, I think, because I used to think that you had to know if something was certain to hope for it because you don't want to get your hopes dashed. But now I see that hope helps you to be resilient, and having faith in something uncertain is just quite magical.
Yeah, that was completely my relationship with it. And I hated hope when I was trying to conceive. Like, I think because when I first got pregnant, I was so hopeful and I almost didn't have any doubts. And so I had built up this future of, you know, this daughter we'd have and all this thing we'd do. So then when I miscarried, that hope, it was so much worse because I had not, I guess, self-protected in any way. And my hope felt so like it was just the reality that I then was so like hated hope. And I was like, I was so negative. I was like, I never want to hope again. Like, let's just assume the worst in everything. And then that's safe. That was my strategy. And because, you know, when you're trying to get pregnant, you're hoping every month, like every month, you feel foolish or you just kind of get your heart broken again when you're let down. And I didn't have that before miscarrying, but afterwards it just suddenly all felt much more high stakes. But it was the Melanie Reed, who I'd interviewed, who's tetraplegic, who had the hope to walk again, who said that even though that hope wasn't, you know, she hasn't walked again, the hope got her through that period of time that was so dark. And she needed to hope. Like, if she hadn't have had that hope, she wouldn't have, you know, she wouldn't have got through those days. And she just helped me to see that hope is just not about the outcome. Mm-hmm. It's not about being proved right or wrong. I think that's with my miscarriage. I was like, my hope's been proven wrong. It was wrong. I mustn't hope again. But actually, that's not what hope is. It's like completely divorced from the outcome. It's this beautiful act of courage and a form of self-love to decide, you know. Now I think of it with dating. Like, I think it's so courageous when you're hopeful and you approach dating. Yeah. And that's now how I want to try and approach everything, knowing that if you get your heart broken, not hoping is not going to protect you from that. So it's like, actually, even if I had not hoped, I still would have been devastated miscarrying or a breakup or a bad date. It's just when you realize like a lack of hope is not a form of self-protection.
Yeah. Yeah. And at least you might as well hope then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's, you know, it's just, you can either exist in this state of hope and be heartbroken, or exist in this negative, cynical space and still be heartbroken.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this kind of picks up on something else I wanted to talk about, which is the idea of giving up control. Mm. And I think it came up a few times in the book, and it's something that I've been thinking about as well, you know, about the role of chance when it comes to finding love, and how much do we actually have control over when it comes to finding love. And also the kind of the tendency to want to either hold back if we can't see any certainty in something, or to kind of try and control something so much to get the outcome that we want. Mm. What did you learn in writing this book? What did you learn about the relationship between control and love?
It's such a complicated one, because my understanding now is that it's not very fashionable, or it's not very easy to try love, to kind of accept that you do have control over whether you are signing up to a dating app, for example, or actively looking for love in whatever way that looks like for you. You know, the idea that I had of like, I'll sit on a plane and chance will throw me a partner who'll sit down beside me, like in Alain de Botton's book.
And
every time I was on a plane, I would think this, or on a train, or ideally in a bookshop. You know, that was my teenage idea of love, and it just didn't happen. And if I had just waited for luck or chance to throw me something, I honestly do think I would still be single. For me, that wasn't my experience of how it happened. So I had to let go of that idea of chance in order to, and kind of understand that I did have some control about putting myself in the right places and trying and just using time to consciously look for love. Mm. Like that was, so that you do have control in that way. But then on the other side of that, I think that you can do all those things and you might not meet someone when you'd hope to. And it's really, really important to know that you do need a bit of luck, and that doesn't mean that it's not like, doesn't mean you're unlovable or you're flawed or something wrong with you compared to somebody who has had more luck and met somebody. And I think that I, for a long time, did think that being single at a time when I didn't want to be was a sign that maybe there was something wrong with me. When actually, if I look at now my friendship group, people had really good luck. They happened to meet someone at a job. I actually worked in a job that was all women and I'm straight, so that wasn't going to happen. You know, I think it's really important that we bring luck back into it for that reason. Mm. And also what we were saying about choosing somebody and not knowing what life's going to look like. You know, mm-hmm. that is, my husband and I do weather change really well together. I did not know that in the first 6 months when we started dating. That's a bit of luck that you've managed to meet someone, you know, get past the first awful bits of dating and not like, you know, I could have just cancelled a date because I was hungover and then he would have gone away and we wouldn't have pursued things. In that beginning stage, it's so fragile and you don't know how, you don't know what's going to happen. So there's a few little bits of luck that could send you on a different course.
Yeah.
So I think that you have to allow for luck when you're meeting somebody so that you don't feel like too much of a failure if it doesn't happen. But then I think when it comes to sustaining love, I do think a lot more of it is in our control, and we have a lot of responsibility to react to things and keep understanding our partner, keep putting in the effort to know them, keep prioritizing all the different relationships in our lives. And I think that it can be, you know, it can be easy to think when you have people that you don't have to take control of how you love, but I think you definitely do.
And how you show up.
Yeah, like it's, that is all, none of that is luck. You know, things will happen to every single person. Like there's never going to be a kind of unstained life for any of us. There is no like lucky life where nothing happens or nothing goes wrong. So how you react to all those things is what's in your control. But the other final thing, control in friendship, I think I write, it's sometimes easier to withdraw from a friendship when it gets difficult, because then you feel like you are more in control and you're less vulnerable. And I think for me, I had learned to not just try and withdraw because that meant I had more control, to actually sometimes sit with awkwardness in friendships and to sometimes not just try and avoid any feeling that might be uncomfortable, and not to try and control another person is really, you know, I think about that in parenthood, like, you know, particularly hard not to try and control your children, and because you have a certain version of their life that you want them to live, like that is very difficult, I can imagine, for many parents. And I think even in a couple, like if someone does something a certain way, like you can't try and control the way they might behave in a situation. It just, it's just, I think that there's the Gottmans, you know, said to me, is like, if your partner does something, if they're telling you a story, like say it was an interaction with a teacher of your child at school, and they kind of did something that you don't really agree with, and the other person, you can kind of be like, well, I think that teacher was right. You should never take that teacher's side and be like, you were wrong in that situation, I think that teacher was right. Because actually your job is to, at first, you know, that'll shut them down and they won't come to you again with some sort of issue or problem. And actually your job is to kind of make space enough so they can like be honest about how they're feeling, rather than trying to control how they behave, because it's not what you would have done in the situation. And just, it just, the idea that they will behave and react exactly how you will. Like, I wouldn't want to be with someone who reacts and behaves exactly as I do. And yet at the same time, if Dan does it, I'll be like, oh, I would have done it this way. But you just can't be like that in a relationship. I think it's Heather Havrilsky said her husband was moaning about his back for ages, and she has a bad neck and she doesn't moan. So she said there's the temptation to be like, why are you moaning? She wants to, you know, she could have been like, I want to control this. You should not moan because I don't.
Yeah.
But she's like, that's the death of love. As soon as you try and make someone or will someone to act the way you do, you have to say, this is part of their flawed, beautiful existence, and actually loving them for the whole of that. Rather than trying to control it into like your version of it, is kind of part of what love is.
Yeah. And that is the lifelong project, I think.
Yeah. So that's hard. That is really hard.
So how has the process of writing this book changed your relationship to love and loss?
I am more peaceful, or I'm more at peace with the inevitability of loss, for starters, but I think I'm just more aware of what Stephen Gross calls the everydayness of loss, and how with every new thing, for instance, becoming a mother, for the new love that that's let into my life also means like a loss of parts of myself for a while, a version of my relationship, and just understanding more that loss is natural, I think. And before, I might have panicked if I'd be like, well, we're not doing this, you know, we're not able to go on holiday and do this anymore, or I'm not able to be spontaneous with my friends, or we can't have sex every day we like to. All these things might have panicked me, but I understand more now that loss is part of us having new experiences, allowing new things into our lives. And actually the only way to completely protect ourselves from any loss would be to be have this really stagnant, fossilized existence, which would be miserable. So I would say it's taught me that I'm more aware of how loss is a part of not just love, but just everything, and not to fear that as much as I once did, because I see that it leads to beautiful things too. Like the example that Stephen gave is, you know, from when you're really young, you have to go to nursery, which is so traumatic for this kid. And then, but you make loads of new friends in the nursery. So, and you leave home and all your school friends to go to university, but then you have all these amazing experiences there. So definitely the everydayness of loss. And also just understanding that loss is at the heart of love, and they are two sides of the same coin, and that love exists inside and beyond loss. And so many of the people I've spoken to still have relationships with the people that they've lost every day. They talk about it like a conversation, and that love, like I tried to include moments where I was like proved wrong. And I said to Greg Wise, like, you know, you lost your sister. He's like, I haven't lost her. She's still here. She died, but she's with me. And she's also in the conversations I have with my family, the memories we share about her. I walk past the house she used to live and I feel her there. So I think it just expanded my understanding of how love might exist beyond life. And then finally, just how love is possible even after loss, like speaking to Justine Picardy, who fell in love again after her divorce, and actually an author called Sarah Collins, who I interviewed recently. Both had felt after their divorce, I'm never going to meet anyone else. I, you know, almost like I've had my love, I'll just enjoy my children. And then just being so hopeful about how love continues to surprise us and be possible, even when we think it's lost and we can never find it again. So that made me feel so hopeful. And I think when you understand love like that, you feel less panic. Like say you're losing a friend, or they're moving away, and or just a friendship isn't working out. I now think, you know, you can fall in love with friends who become best friends in your 70s, I think now. Like it just convinced me that loss is just not an end to love.
Yeah, it helped me to see that you can never really lose love. And I was speaking to you before we hit record about my fear of running out of time. I have a fear of death. And we were talking about that. And I really felt that in these pages, when you talked about loss and just how in love I felt reading those stories that you shared, those conversations with people throughout those pages, it really helped me to be less scared about loss, because as you say, it will happen to all of us in you know, one way or another. And why not talk about our fears of losing our loved ones, and actually talking about grief and actually having conversations about those things that scare us?
Well, also I think I had this idea that I love the people I love so much that I didn't even want to entertain loss. You know, I just shut it out because I love them too much to bear thinking about it. But actually, I understood that allowing for some understanding of loss is also what helps you feel the preciousness of those relationships. And actually understanding that fragility is, you know, it's kind of trite to say, but obviously when we're all at the end of our lives, we will think about the people we love. And yet every day we get distracted and we overlook them. I'm not saying every day must be, everyone's going to die. Oh, I love you. I love you. But there is a certain, I wrote about a moment with Dan, like we were just on a Sunday afternoon and we're just cooking and just being silly in the kitchen. And because I've been having these interviews, I just thought, this is what we will miss. One of us will have to miss this. And I just felt the complete beauty and preciousness. And I just knew that this was the moment, not the wedding day, like this was the moment that I would one day just want to tightly bind to memory. And I think there's been many Sunday afternoons where I just, like, okay, pass the potatoes or whatever. A sense of loss can help us to be more present and to appreciate people. Mm. Not all the time, but if we can use it to find some way to be in those moments occasionally more, I think that's no bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that really resonated because I felt just after I got married, I started thinking about death a lot more than usual. And I shared it with my husband and he said he'd been feeling the same since we got back from our honeymoon. And there was something that Brené Brown said about joy being our most vulnerable emotion. And I think I was just feeling so vulnerable because something you said earlier, you know, the stakes are higher. Now we've got more to lose. And you know what? It made me start to really be grateful. So every morning, if I woke up and I started to think about it, you know, if I had this phase where I would check that my husband Pav was still breathing, which I talked to him about, we laughed about. I think he had a similar thing with me too. Luckily,
I think it's very common.
Yeah, luckily it didn't last too long. But every time I noticed I did that, I started to tell myself, okay, well, if this is, you know, the last day you have together, then be grateful for this day that you have together. And not in a, oh my God, we must make this day amazing because what's around the corner, just in a way that it made me pay attention and really appreciate those mundane moments.
And also understanding it's kind of a privilege to have something to lose.
Yeah, a huge privilege.
And yeah, but it's hard. It's finding the balance between not getting so consumed and obsessed with that fear of loss and not letting it ruin moments because you're always wondering about when you're going to lose someone. That is obviously not healthy, but finding some way to not shut out loss entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that it doesn't become so much of a shock for all of us. And Greg Wise said, speaking about death is an act of love.
Oh yeah. I loved that.
And it did make me have a conversation with my parents, just trying to understand, you know, just not denying it or just not pretending to each other that it would never happen.
Mm. Yeah, it really made me think. I actually texted quite a few people as I was reading the book. It really sort of made me reach out to my mum because I realized I hadn't checked in on her for a while. And I was sending my friend, a friend who I've known for 20 odd years, I'm sending her passages of the book, the bits on friendship that I just really loved. There was one on,
was it Candice Carty-Williams?
Yeah, Candice Carty-Williams talking about how friends see the goodness in us and they reflect our innate goodness back to us. Mm. And I was sending my friend screen grabs of these highlighted pages and she was like, oh my God, it's us. Because we had talked before about how we had helped each other to love because we felt this security in our friendship as this great secure base in which to learn about what it means to love and be loved and to feel valued in our relationships. And there's something you wrote about your friend Marisa. And it was just such a celebration of a friendship love.
And thinking back to what we said about self-love, we don't expect to love ourselves before our friends will.
Yeah.
And
so true.
And I think you're right in that a big part of, you know, especially in the early 20s, like understanding yourself and figuring you're all doing it together. You know, often you live together and, in, you know, I live with the five of us. And that was really a period of figuring out who I was and what I wanted with and alongside those girls. Mm. But it that's why it's complicated in love when, you know, you then move out and some people move in with partners and you move to different parts of the country. And that is a big adjustment in friendships. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, for me, whilst romantic relationships felt impossible in my 20s and friendships felt so easy and I really didn't have to do much to keep them ticking along because I live with them or we spoke every day and it was just easy. Now I'm living with my partner. Obviously that does take work, but friendships certainly require a lot more of active planning. Finding ways to introduce consistency into them is much harder. And this is how it is in love. Different periods of time will bring different people in our lives closer together and farther apart. And we have to, I think, pull back enough to see where the ruptures might occur to to kind of adjust our efforts accordingly.
Mm. Mm. And giving friends the space to change as well. There was something else that that I loved in that bit on friendship. So I'm 36 now, and you know, in the last few years, there's been so much change happen in my friendship group. And I know that this is something that we talked about before, that it's like a thing, you know, in your 30s, there's so much change and transition going on in friendships. And it's kind of, you know, giving people space to change and evolve and not being so attached to this kind of other version of them that you're so familiar with.
Which is easier if you are at a point in life when you are happy, and much harder if you are at a point where you feel you're lacking a certain form of love or your set of circumstances, whatever they may be, you're unhappy.
Mm.
That is really difficult to then find the courage and not resent your friends for, you know, kind of feel like what I felt like being left behind, which is a horrible feeling. And of course, not their responsibility to, you know, they have their own life. And a lot of my friends when I was single were starting families and, you know, they had a lot on their plates and didn't have enough time to be, of course, or wanting to come out every weekend looking for a partner with me in a pub. But I think I tried to show when I was talking about friends getting pregnant and I wasn't, those sort of like resentful, what I felt were ugly feelings, to show that it's natural and also okay to feel those that way when something is changing. But to sort of push through those feelings and be as honest as possible to stay close.
Mm.
And often I don't hear many people say, you know, oh, my friend is really successful and that's really difficult for me because my career is not going well, or being able to say, actually, your pregnancy announcement made me really miserable. Those are really difficult things to say. But when we can say them, that not only kind of helps retain the friendship, but it almost can lead to a closer relationship because then the other person might have space to be more vulnerable about how they're feeling. And, you know, I had assumed that my friends who had kids had this sort of perfect, happy life. And when I sort of moved past my own like ego and just being consumed by my own problems, I realized that they had been going through stuff, of course, too. And there is no easy option for anyone, whatever your life situation is at that moment in time.
Mm. Yeah, there was something that came up a few times about there being sorrow and joy in each, you know, each thing that you go after, or each form of love.
Any life choice.
Any life choice. And, you know, thinking that, yeah, the grass is greener on the other side, and actually realizing that that friend who you envy, for whatever reason, they might be having struggles that they feel they can't share with you. When you dare to be truthful and vulnerable, they feel that they can also, you know, show up in that same way.
Mm. And it comes back to the responsibility word, because rather than festering and being angry about, you know, friends not being there for certain things, the responsibility is on you to be honest about how you're feeling, also to be realistic about what they can give you at that point in their life. And even with the group dynamics thing, I've actually just written about this, how you can fall into a certain role in a friendship group and then people can just assume you're like that. Well, the responsibility again is a little on you to tell them who you are. And to, you know, for instance, in one group of friends from when I was younger, I was very much like the childlike role. So I would be not very practical. I would never speak to the landlord. I would never cook. If we're on holiday, I wouldn't choose the food in the supermarket, because the friends who maybe were slightly, would more take charge, would be like, I want to cook this. And they would almost be like the mothers, I guess, and I would be like the child. And it wasn't until I made friends as an adult when I was older, I realized I do actually enjoy caring and being the mother as well. And sometimes I do want to be the one who's cooking or the more practical one, but I didn't have any space to do that in that group dynamic because I was constantly put in that role. It was amazing to have those new friends who saw a different side of my personality, and I felt so loved because I was able to like be seen for a different version of me. But the onus then is on me realizing that, to not just slip back into the child role with my old friends and to say, actually, hang on, guys, I want to cook tonight. Mm. Can I choose what in the supermarket? No one is going to say, no, I do it. But you have to change those roles and let people know if you've changed and when and how you want to be treated a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, there was something I remember you saying years ago, that in your wedding vows, was it something about promising to always be curious about getting to know each other? What was that line that you said in your vows?
God, you know, I don't. Funnily enough, the only wedding vow we remember is Dan promised to let me warm my cold feet on his feet, and he's been regretting it ever since. For all these emotional vows, I was like, this is the best vow, because I always, he's like, hates it. And I was like, wedding vow? He's like, oh, God. But yeah, it would have been something about being, always being curious about each other.
Asking who you are.
Yes. Yeah.
So I've remembered your wedding vow more than.
Yeah. There you go.
You have to tell Dan that.
That is something so easy to forget. It's so simple. Mm. And it's not sitting down and saying, who are you today? It's really noticing and also being open to ways that your partner can surprise you. It is amazing to me how often Dan will still surprise me. I mean, we haven't been together as long as you, but I'm sure you have the same. You know someone for 10 years and there's still parts of them that you will never know and that appear and surprise you. And that's like one of the best things about long-term love.
Mm, yeah. Well, I've really found that in the pandemic, because we've had to adapt and evolve so much over the last year. And I recently wrote about that in my Sunday love letter, how we're just constantly changing and evolving, sometimes in really subtle ways. And if we can pay attention and really notice it, it can be really magical. There's this practice that we started doing in early lockdown, a gratitude practice, where every evening over dinner, we'll do our G's. So we have three G's that we say, and then we do a fourth G for gratitude to each other.
Oh, I love it.
And I was reflecting on a year of doing this recently, and I think it's really helped us to be resilient, you know, through the last, 12 months and all of its challenges. But it's really helped us to keep seeing each other and to be seen.
So, what kind of things would you have on your cheer list?
So it'd be like, oh, I'm really grateful for this podcast on my walk this morning. You know, it really inspired me, really helped me to look at things a different way. Or really grateful that our neighbours started dropping off, he drops off fresh bread. He works in a cafe. And if he makes too much, he comes over and drops some off. So sometimes we have this really lovely sourdough bread. And so it'd be like, you know, grateful that he came over and dropped that off, or grateful for something funny our dog buddy did that day. We have another thing called a radical G, which is like...
I love this.
Which is where something's been really tough and challenging and we've found it really difficult to be in it, but we've been able to like rise to the challenge, or maybe we learned something through the difficulty of it. Flowers, fresh flowers. I'm just looking at the fresh flowers that that I've bought to woo Natasha. And
I did notice. I feel very wooed.
And to woo my husband and myself too. But yesterday that was an RG's, fresh flowers. So it could be anything. But
I love this.
It's just this act of just, you know,
noticing
things, paying attention. And I've really noticed the impact of it, you know, doing it for a year now. But it takes literally 5 minutes. But that little practice every day has helped me to keep knowing who Pav is, you know, through this really, you know, unique time in history that we're all navigating together.
This is, I do think, people can kind of roll their eyes at like gimmicky things and little like tricks. But there's Sarah Hapola, the writer I interviewed, she said to me, you know, our natural state is pretty lazy, egotistical, cranky. You know, unfortunately, that's like a gear we can all shift into. And so people need to find, like, some people meditate, some people run, whatever thing that you need to find to like basically keep pulling yourself out of that, I think is useful. And I wish that we didn't need these little games and gimmicks, but we do, I think.
I do.
And this is kind of what having these conversations have been for me. because every time I remember when I was really sort of like overlooking all the love, like obsessed with getting pregnant and just so fearful of what was going to happen. And I interviewed Lady Antonia Fraser, so Harold Pinter's wife. And she spoke about losing him, and she spoke about how she just wished that she, you know, she just craved to have him back. And she, they were so in love. And she said she wished she hadn't wasted a second, a millisecond of their life together, worrying about the fact that he was going to die and because he was very sick, or worrying about his care, worrying about all the stuff. She was like, what waste? You know, such joy they had together. And I just like stood on the doorstep outside her house office, like, what am I doing? Like this relationship that I had spent majority of my life searching for is so important to me, and it's so rewarding and so fun and so sexy. It's just full of such precious things. And I've just kicked it to the curb in pursuit of this other thing. And I had the sense then that if we didn't have a baby, I would be devastated, but we would still have different adventures and a different life. And it took that conversation to trick me out of it. So I think whether it's like a little gratitude game or, you know, I played the School of Life game. I don't know if you've seen that. It's like, you'd love it. It's called like Connect Game. And because obviously we're new parents, we don't have much time to like ask who the other is at the moment. So we made margaritas and we played this game, and it's split into like appreciation, desire, I don't know, five different sections. And you just ask each other questions. And even through that very simple like game, and I think Dan was a bit like, oh, what's this game? But we had such a fun conversation. We laughed and, you know, we talked about like sexual stuff that we probably wouldn't have like talked about that evening. And just this little game had like opened up a completely different evening. So I might try the G's.
And I might try the School of Life game.
You'd love it. You really love it.
And the margaritas. Oh, that's inspired me. Yeah. Cocktails.
You would, honestly, Vicky, you would love the game.
I'm pretty sure I would love the game.
Yeah.
So there is a question that you ask everybody at the end of your conversation interviews, and that is, what do you wish that you'd known about love? So what do you wish that you'd known about love?
I should have prepared an answer for this.
I think you've answered it.
Because there's so many different things. It's like how to sum up.
But there's many things I think you share in the book. Maybe give us one thing.
Yeah, I think the thing that I struggled with the most that has turned out to be not only... that has turned out to be a beautiful thing is the uncertainty and mystery in love. And I think I wrestled against this for so long. I wanted to know when I was going to meet a partner, who that partner was going to be, when we were going to have a baby, when we might have a second baby, how long we both live for, would someone get sick? I just found this uncertainty in how my life might, or how the love in my life might pan out, unbearable. And where I have got to now is understanding that that mystery and uncertainty is one of the things that makes love beautiful. Like, it's not a problem to be solved because there is no end point. There is no way of knowing absolutely everything. And I made myself so miserable trying to like fight that feeling. And actually what I wish I'd known is that that mystery is what makes me continue to fall in love with someone who I've known for 6 years. It's what makes me see a different side of a friend and fall more in love with them all over again. And it leads to so much beauty if you can find the courage to tolerate it. So I think what I wish I'd known is that tolerating the mystery in love will make it more beautiful.
I love that.
Yeah, it's difficult though. I found it so hard and I still have it all the time. But we just never really, like, we never really know ourselves. I'm always constantly surprised by something that might come up in myself in a reaction or a new challenge with a friend. And it's the same with my mom or with my friend or with Dan. that's part of the beauty of love, that we can never fully know people or never fully know ourselves. Mm. It's just constantly flitting between different selves and versions, and that's what keeps it interesting.
Mm. And that there'll never be certainty in love.
No. And also that I wrote at the end, if I could have chosen my love in my life, it would look very different to how it's panned out. And I wouldn't have put in all the really boring bits or all the really sad bits, all the painful things that happen. I would have just put in this pristine version of love in a life. And, you know, the reason that my life, like take my relationship, the reason all the bits of it that have been forged in the difficult moments are what make it more beautiful now. Like that sounds so cheesy, but now when we're encountering something that's hard, you know, I feel like the richness of our layers, like I look at Dan, I remember like him holding my hand in a hospital waiting room. And I remember like the first time I held him as I cried. And I remember us being like stuck in an airport for 8 hours and making up silly games. Like all these bad things that have happened or boring things or like inconvenient things add the texture to the relationship that makes it more beautiful than the one I could have imagined that was perfect and had a kind of easy time.
Oh, so beautiful. I feel like it's the same feeling that I got from reading the book, feeling in love, talking about love, and just so how fun. I feel right now.
Well, I love talking to you and my fellow lover of love.
Yeah. Well, from one lover of love to another, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and for your second appearance.
I know, I feel extra honoured.
Yeah. Thank you for writing this book. It's such a gift. I can't wait for people to read it. It is just the most beautiful, expansive book about love that I think I've ever read. So thank you so much for writing it.
Thank you for reading it.
And thank you for being our guest today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Project Love podcast. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, then come and subscribe on iTunes, and we'll deliver each new episode straight to your device. And we would love it if you would leave us a review to help us spread the love far and wide. And if you can't think of anything to write, then just tap 5 stars and say, best podcast ever. Thank you.